Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWiT Photo with Sarah Lane filling in for Leah LaPorte and Catherine Hall. Episode 54, recorded Tuesday, April 24th, 2012. Doug Kay. This episode of TWiT Photo is brought to you by Netflix. Watch thousands of TV episodes and movies on your PC, Mac, iPad, iPhone, or TV instantly. All streamed directly to you, saving you time, money, and hassle. For your free 30-day trial, go to netflix.com/twit. Welcome to another episode of TWiT Photo. I am not Catherine Hall, nor am I Leo Laporte. They are both gallivanting around fjords in Norway this week. That's a true story, by the way. Leo and Catherine are in Norway getting a bunch of footage for another version of TWiT Photo, but you are stuck with me today. They've graciously asked me to fill in on the show, but it's not just me. I am not alone. I have two esteemed photography guests, one in studio, Doug Kay. Welcome.
Thank you, sir. Good to see you.
Good to see you, too. And one via Skype, Trey Ratcliffe. How the heck are you?
Hi, Sarah and Doug. How are you guys?
We are good.
I like the hair.
Yeah, well,
it's that kind of a Calvin and Hobbes look.
Yeah, it's crazy today. You know, I'm not at home. I'm living away. I'm at my dad's house, and I don't have all my situation together, and my life is wild, but I'm happy to be here with you guys.
Well, we're happy to have you, too, especially since you do have a kind of a crazy life, because I follow you on the social networks, and it's hard to keep track of where you are at any given time.
Yeah, social networks, they'll be big someday.
Now, Doug, you and I had just met for the first time before this show, but you're very familiar with TWiT. You've been on TWiT before, but never actually in our brick house here. You were always at the old cottage down the street.
That's true. I was a guest with Leo for about a dozen shows, and I think the last one was probably at least 2 or 3 years ago.
Wow.
And that's before I was in the photography world. So this will be a different one for me.
So this is where the story gets really interesting. You say a couple of years ago you were on TWiT, and I thought to myself, oh, it must have been maybe a photography episode or something like that, good friend of Leo. But you were in a completely different line of work.
That's right.
So what happened?
Okay. I am officially a recovering or retired tech executive.
Uh-huh.
And I left the tech and dot-com world a number of years ago. And now I am a full-time amateur nonprofit photographer.
So what? Why the big change? I mean, when you say you're a recovering tech executive, what made you decide to switch gears?
Well, I left the last dot-com job way back in 2001, mm-hmm. So it's been a long time. And I was a consultant for a while in the tech world. I had been in the software business for a total of almost 28 years, I think. And, you know, consulting sort of wound down, and I sort of wound down and wrote a couple of books. But then in 2009, I was getting ready for a trip with my wife to Kenya. And I said, well, you can't go to Kenya without a camera.
Right.
So my wife got me a D90, and I had to learn how to use it.
Uh-huh.
And the last 3 or 4 years, that's the history. Now I'm a photographer. I've gone crazy full-time into it since then.
So I think that your story is sort of the fantasy story for a lot of people who say, well, I love photography. Wouldn't that be nice if I could just drop everything and make that my career? And a D90 is a camera that I think is within a lot of people's reach, even when it was new. It was a very, very good camera, but something that was at least something that a consumer could imagine buying. How much ramping up did you have to go through before you felt like you knew what you were doing?
Well, years ago, I had a background in photography. You know, I studied lighting design as an undergraduate. I studied cinematography in grad school. But I dropped all that in the 28 years in between. Didn't even own a real camera at all. So I was comfortable with the technical parts of photography. I had a lot of ramping up to do on the more creative side, even though I had studied those things.
Mm-hmm.
And as a geek, you know, the tech part came pretty easy. But when I look back to that D90 and what it was like to shoot, you know, for the first year, I said, my God, it's amazing I got any shots out of it at all.
Trey, you're not a big Nikon guy, right?
Have you ever?
I thought he wasn't. I thought you were always crapping all over Nikon because you liked Canon.
No.
Do I have that backwards?
I love Nikon.
Oh, you do?
Yeah, Nikon cameras complete me.
And okay, so.
But Doug, my first one was a D70, and I can't believe I was able to squeeze many good shots out of that either. But really, it doesn't really matter. I don't know how many of these ones you're going to show today are from your D90. But actually, you know, as you start to upgrade, there's only little margins of error that you start to see the improvement in. These early cameras, I bet, Doug, now you're so experienced, right, or whatever, I bet you go back to a D90 and do amazing photos.
Except that I sold it. But I could. I think so, absolutely. They wouldn't be amazing, maybe, but they'd be better than they were.
But isn't that the story that you hear over and over from people who are actually professional is that, yes, the tools are very important, and certain tools can give you amazing results, but really it's having some sort of photography eye and skill and knowing how to compose a photo that's going to wow people, and the instrument that you use to create that photo is only part of the solution.
Sure. I think the whole question about gear is one that we talk about all the time, right?
Right.
It's not about the gear. Unless you're a geek, then it really is all about the gear. But it's, you know, the reason you upgrade the gear is that there are those sort of borderline shots that you wouldn't quite be able to get if you didn't have a better camera. But it's only those marginal shots. Most of the shots that people take, they could take with a much simpler camera, I think. You know, for example, I have my current camera is a Nikon D3S, which I love because it's very good in low light, mm-hmm. and it's got a very rapid frame rate. And there are times when those help me get shots I might not otherwise be able to get. But rarely. I have to say it's rare.
And how long did it take you to figure out once you started taking pictures and you said, I really want to put some effort into this. I've got my D90 and I'm going to shoot all day, that sort of thing. How long did it take you before you said, you know, I've really got something here? Maybe enough people had complimented you or wondered how you got this amazing photo or you got a certain amount of attention. Did you create a blog and try to get the word out that this is what you were doing all the time now?
Well, it really happened a little less than a year ago, I'd say. One of the big things that changed, well, let's see, a year and a half ago, I joined a local photo club, mm-hmm. which made a big difference because I was interacting with photographers and I was actually competing monthly with photography. Uh-huh. And the other thing was Google Plus. And, you know, Trey's talked about that a lot and starting to interact with other photographers. And then last summer, I changed my title to photographer. I mean, just that sort of symbolic gesture of saying I'm no longer an executive of this, because I do have some work I do, but I just said, no, I'm gonna tell the world I'm a photographer. And that commitment made a big difference.
Hey, so Doug, what's it been like? You know, how has your life changed? Because now you're kind of in this right-brained creative world, and you used to be over in this sort of left-brain, analysis mode. How is your life different? Is it fuller? Is it, how do you feel?
Yeah, it's much fuller. But what's interesting is I tend to take a left brain approach to all the right brain problems, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, when I've got something that's creative, I analyze it.
Yeah.
You know, it's just nature, you know, and try to come to grips with, you know, try to analyze what the creative process is. I think, If my work has gotten better creatively, it's through the technical and the analysis of what does it take to make a better image.
So I talked to lots of people that go through this transition from sort of a left brain tech world into a right brain creative world. There's an increasing number of people doing this. It's sort of a fascinating trend. I think everyone has sort of this artist that's been beaten down inside of them over time, and then maybe later in your life it has a chance to come out and play. So as you kind of gotten into this mode, your circle of friends, right, your real life social network, they're probably all still in that world. What do they think of your sudden entree into being an artiste?
Well, you know, there are a couple of different worlds, right? There's my tech friends who think I'm an absolutely amazing photographer, but not too good in technology. And then and then there are the people who are my photographer friends who say, yeah, he's an up-and-coming photographer, but he was probably really good in tech. So, you know, you play those two worlds, right? But I do think, I do think the analytical part has got me through the creative part. I still struggle with the creative part. I look at things that you and other people do, and I have to sort of analyze them to figure out why I like them. And that helps me build up my photography. But really, as I said, the social aspects, the Google Plus part of it, even, you know, Flickr to some extent, but mostly Google Plus has been such an amazing resource for making my photography better.
I know, Trey, you and I have talked about this a little bit before, because I like Google Plus, but I have my own issues with it as a social network as compared to other social networks that do different things. But I'm also not calling myself a photographer, and I don't know that the community, that's such a niche community that has seemed to flourish so well on Google Plus specifically. Is that not the sort of thing you can get from a social network like Facebook or even a community on Twitter?
Well, I mean, I was on Facebook early, mm-hmm. and I became a Facebook slut, which meant I said yes to everybody. So it's now not very valuable to me.
I did that too. What a mess.
So Google Plus started end of June. And I was there on day one, and the timing was such that I only circled photographers. So my circles there are totally photography related. My friends there are totally photography related. I don't discuss any, and in fact, if someone isn't posting images, they're not in my circles.
So you've just made Google Plus a photography network for you.
Yes.
Even though you could be anything.
That's correct.
You've just kept it as specific.
Yeah. I mean, I would never know what else was going on in Google Plus except for the photography I see.
That's actually probably a really, really good way to use it. Trey, do you do that too, or you have your photographer friends and then everybody else?
Yeah, I have a few different circles, for tech and science and photography. So I do find that Google Plus is it's a place for passions. And once you get enough people that are passionate about a subject in there, then it becomes a live, vibrant community. And really, the passions, this is what makes life worth living, you know. And so it's a great place. No matter what you're into, you can find something that you can find like-minded people. Because really, a lot of, especially photographers, we practice our passions alone. It's a very solitary, lonely existence. But then when you get on and start to see there's other people out there that are struggling with the same issues as you, they have questions similar to you, it's just a nice place for us to go hang out and be together and learn from one another. And I see it as a source of inspiration and cooperation and sort of a, not really competitive, but sort of just a soft medium that we all can go out and create together. And it's different. I can't quite put my finger on it, but it feels nice.
Doug, what kind of photography would you say? We've been looking at some of your pictures. Beautiful stuff. Are you more into landscape? Do you do portraits? Do you even define yourself in a way? I assume that people say, well, what kind of photography do you do? What kind? You say you're a photography now on your business card, but more specifically, what's your thing?
Yeah, I mean, you understand the issue there very well. As a still learning photographer, I'll shoot almost anything, right?
Mm-hmm.
To answer that question, I've had to go back and look at my own stuff to say, what kind of photographer am I? I don't do much in landscapes. I leave that to people like Trey. For some reason, I'm not attracted to landscapes in particular. I think the stuff I like the best is urban by nature. Not portraits, but interesting urban things. That image, that's an HDR image taken at Mare Island. I'm proud of that one. I was working on a series of images I call closed, taking pictures of the interiors of closed buildings and closed retail establishments. And this was an HDR image taken through some chicken wire-filled glass at a big old building in Mare Island, California.
Now, I don't know if you've ever thought of this, but looking at your photos, I seem to notice an angular theme. Mm-hmm. It's almost like geometrical. And I wonder if some of your past work that's more of an analytic numbers game somehow comes into your creative process.
Well, what you should do is you should ask people to doodle and see what they draw right. when they just doodle. Uh-huh. And you'd see my doodles are very angular, very linear, no curves to them whatsoever. Yes, I mean, there's another one, right? Typical example. That's a typical Doug shot right there. Good observation.
And where is that?
That's on the High Line in New York City.
Oh, yeah. That's right? That's the Standard Hotel?
I have no idea.
Or one of the...
I'm not sure what it is, but it's on the west side of the High Line. They've got some marvelous buildings there. If you ever get a chance in New York, Trey, have you shot there before?
Yeah, I've shot. The High Line is a great place to shoot.
Yeah.
Hey, Doug, let me feed off something as I was asking you about your photography, because, you know, relative to a lot of photographers that have been doing this their whole lives, you've been at it a pretty short time, but you've been able to come up with, like, lots of really interesting, you know, well-conceived and well-executed photos. Why do you think, you're very analytical, why do you think that you've been able to take to this very quickly while other people are much slower to get to this point? Not that speed to proficiency is better than taking your time to proficiency, but why do you think that you've been able to go through these stepping stones so quick?
Well, thank you for the compliment. I work at it. I mean, I believe that the creative part of photography is something that you can learn just as you can learn the technical side of photography. So I interact with photographers. I read a fair amount. I mean, some of the David Duchemin books are particularly good, I found, the e-books that he's published. I look at a lot of photography, but I work at it. And I don't think it's unique to me. I don't think it's an inherent skill that I have. I think that I'm just very lucky that I have the time to work on it and that I do put that time in. My wife will tell you I tend to go full saturation mode on anything I do. I sort of dive in and, you know, I don't sleep much. I used to have a sign that says sleep is the enemy. And that's sort of how I do things. And so I've just worked at it really, really hard. I hope I will continue to do so and continue to improve.
When you decide what you're going to shoot, do you do a lot of wandering through a city? And when you see those windows that, wow, cast some sort of a purple hue, then you start to shooting. Is there a lot of research that goes into maybe the walk that you're going to do?
Not much. I mean, when I go back to a location a second or a third time, like the Golden Gate Bridge is something that people around here shoot a lot, and I've been there many times. Mm-hmm. On one hand, I have a plan. On the other hand, you never know what the fog's going to do, so you get surprised. But I do, for example, you know, Catherine's doing a photo walk at the Google Plus conference. Mm-hmm. I'm going to be working with her. She's going to be at Fisherman's Wharf. But I'm going to go out to Fisherman's Wharf a couple of weeks before that and shoot that first, so I have a good idea of what the potential is for that. But you know, and then I do some stuff in the studio too. I have a studio at home, which my wife refers to as the dining room. Little does she know, right? And in the studio, that's very different. That's very focused and intentional, and you know. Obviously, you're sitting there and you're controlling everything about the shot. So that's the other extreme. But I do a lot. I would say the majority is you go to a place and you develop an eye. You start to see things in a different way. And that's really hard work for someone who doesn't have that built in. Hmm. Right? You start to look at the shadows of things instead of the things themselves. You start to look at the shapes, the lines, the curves, and you start to abstract what you're looking at. You see the patterns instead of just the overall things. This image was fun. I got to go with Joe McNally to Alcatraz. Special groups can get into Alcatraz at night when there's nobody else there. And we had a group of about 35 people that Joe led. And we got to cruise Alcatraz all by ourselves. That was fun.
We should mention, you mentioned the photo walk that you and Catherine are going to be guides for, but that's happening on May 21st.
Yes.
And if people want to know more about this, it's before the Google Plus Photographers Conference. Trey, I think you're doing one of your own photo walks. Doug and Catherine's is at gpluspc.com/register if you're interested in participating. Definitely a good group of folks.
We'll probably start at the same place because you're doing the Embarcadero, I think. Trey, is that right?
Yeah. We may start together and then go in separate directions. Yeah. I don't know the exact start location, but there's when you sign up for the conference, which I am not putting on, by the way. I think I mentioned this last night in our show. I think people thought it was my conference. It's not. I'm just showing up. But anyway, there's when you sign up, you get to pick from 10 different photo walks. And yeah, Catherine and Doug are doing that one on the Fisherman's Wharf.
So that's a good example of something where you say, well, you know, you could just show up and it would be fun and you'd get a lot out of it. But if maybe you give a visit a couple of weeks in advance, you get a much better idea of, if this light was hitting this, the pier just so, what a picture this would be.
I mean, I have a good friend, Scott Loftus, and he and I shoot together all the time. We try and shoot at least once every 2 weeks. And it's funny how we both show up. I spend the night before agonizing what lenses and what body to take. Scott shows up with the same camera and lens every time. He'll carry around maybe some small camera around his neck. I've got a backpack full of gear. And the only difference is that the second time I shoot, then I know exactly what I want to have. But I'm sort of the Boy Scout of be prepared for anything.
You're more of a planner rather than fix it in post kind of person.
No, I'm definitely a fix it in post, but yeah. I'm more of a panicker, right? Which is, oh my God.
That's like me when I pack for vacation.
Yeah, I don't want to
bring everything.
I don't want to be caught without the right shoes. That's it. Got to have the right shoes. So, I'll take way too much gear on these things. But, last week, I rented a little Fuji X-Pro1, a new camera from Fujifilm, and I forced myself to take that with a 35mm prime lens only. That's the only camera I took. I had a horrible time sleeping the night before. Even the moment before I got in the car, I said, can I really do this? Can I leave my big camera at home? I did it, and I was successful. I'm very proud of myself for that.
Hey, what do you think of that camera?
So. It was fun. In fact, Frederick Van Jansen and I did a review of it, which you can find at This Week in Photo. He just posted it yesterday, in fact, the video. We did it as a Hangout, Google Hangout. Mm-hmm. It's what surprised me was how it's not much better than, let's say, a D7000. It's not that much smaller. It's not that much lighter. And it certainly doesn't have the flexibility or the autofocus speed of a D7000. So, the bottom line is, I think that if you're using if you're already into Nikon or Canon or Sony, and you're into a crop sensor body already, I don't know why you'd necessarily go to something like that. Have you played with one?
Yeah, I played with one. I also bought a Sony NEX7, yeah. Which I prefer to that. That Fuji. I think the Sony has a better EVF, but that Fuji that you had, man, it has that EVF. And when you get up close to something in macro mode and you just focus on that, and then the background falls away into this delicious bokeh, I've never seen anything like that. I was really shocked to look at that digital bokeh right there live in the EVF. I was really, really impressed.
Yeah, I agree. I think the viewfinder is terrific. There we go.
Nice ringtone.
That's my dad's phone. Sorry.
I thought the electronic viewfinder was one of the best features of it. I mean, I love having, you can bring up the menus in the viewfinder. You've got the histogram in the viewfinder. I was very impressed with that part of it. But overall, it's $500 more than a D7000, and for that, you can buy a lens. So, yeah. I didn't rush out and buy one. I saved myself the money by renting one, you see.
Yeah, you could try it out.
That's right.
And then you can buy it if you like it.
That's good.
So you mentioned you are not, you do not shy away from post-processing. And
no,
I do
a lot of posts.
With your tech background, you're probably familiar with a lot of these programs already over, the course of many years. What's your general process? What are your favorite programs?
Well, I'm a Lightroom user for everything. I mean, I shoot almost everything in RAW, mm-hmm. Bring it into Lightroom. I used to go into Photoshop for almost every image. until Lightroom 4 came out. And for some reason, some of the features of Lightroom 4 are just enough that I would say now less than half of my images I have to go into Photoshop to deal with. I've been through an interesting transition there, too, because in February, I started a 365 project, which was shoot and publish an image every day.
And which is surprisingly harder than people think it's going to be, right?
It is. It is, especially if you're traveling. You know, you're on an airplane all day, so you get a shot out the window or a shot in an airport terminal. But I thought that would be a good thing for my photography. Well, it backfired after about a month. I realized it was absolutely the wrong thing for me because whereas a lot of people will publish, you know, Thomas Hawk, for example, Thomas is trying to shoot a million publish a million images before he dies.
Is that actually the goal?
That is the goal.
That is his stated goal.
And Thomas will probably make it if he stays alive long enough and doesn't hurt himself. But I realized that my photography is much more deliberative, much more post-processing. The images I'm proud of, I'll spend, hours in post.
Yeah.
So I can't do that. I can't shoot one a day, let alone a million before I die. So I stopped my 365 project because I realized that for the things that I care about, I wanted to tweak and perfect the images more.
Well, it's not as if you're not shooting prolifically. It's just that you're not, I guess, publishing, right? Because I can't imagine that you'd spend 5 days just to take one photo with your shutter. You're taking a bunch.
It's also a matter of, Thomas is a great photographer. He can shoot a million images. I mean, he's up to 200,000 already.
Mm-hmm.
He can shoot that many images and do very well. For me, it's a matter of not being a snapshot shooter.
Mm-hmm.
That's a struggle for somebody who's transitioning from taking family pictures to becoming a serious photographer, amateur or pro. So the transition from snapshots to photography is a fascinating challenge. It's one that intrigues me, but it also means that the 365 project was actually a step in the wrong direction.
You know, you hear a lot of times when people are trying to get into the field of writing, successful writers, or at least people who have been doing it for a lot longer, will say, just write. Like, that's the number one thing that you can do to get better at it, is just write all the time, even if it's terrible. Just do it all the time. It sounds like for you, it wasn't the same kind of process for photography because you had to start thinking about it in a different way. You weren't just going to take a picture of everything that you saw around you because that's a little bit more snapshotty, a little bit more amateur.
Well, I'd get up in the morning and maybe it was a crummy day and I didn't want to necessarily go out and run around. So I'd go into the garden and take a macro picture of some leaves.
Mm-hmm.
And, I would be technically interesting and blah, blah, but it wasn't, there was no inspiration.
You were putting artificial constraints around what you were supposed to be doing.
Yeah, whereas you go to a good location that's interesting and you can cover it in a variety of ways, you can interpret it many ways, but you might get a good half a dozen shots out of one location. And then you might spend a week dealing with those half a dozen images. So
there's another, Doug, there's another school of thought on this 365 thing.
Who found that gallery? Was that Tony?
That's Tony.
Yeah. Tony, yeah. You're snooping around through the galleries, aren't you? Sorry, Trey, go ahead.
Candy shot. Woo.
Tony's very sneaky.
Go ahead, Trey, sorry.
So there's this other school of thought when it comes to these 365 projects, and I'm on the same side as you, Doug. I don't force myself to take a photo every single day. I think you should just go take photos when the muse visits. At least that's what works well with my personality type. But there's another personality type out there, which I think is actually a bigger portion of the populace. And this was brought up to me by Kevin Kelly. He was one of the founders of Wired. He wrote this book called What Technology Wants, and he's very analytical, like us. And so he has this fascinating story about a ceramics class. You know, they make pottery. And one half of the class was told, okay, you guys just make one amazing pot. You have the whole semester, just make one amazing pot. You can just make one pot. You can make as many as you want. All these people really want to make good pots. That's the goal. They're not just slackers. They all want to make good pots. The other group had to come make a pot every single day, whether or not they wanted to. And across the board, the better pots at the end of the semester came from the people that were forced to make a pot every single day. But I think there are certain body types, I think maybe like yours and mine, that, and I don't know what that is, but that maybe that 365 a day project will not work for you. So if it's not working for you, but everyone says it should be working for you, maybe it's just not for you and you learn in a slightly different way.
I think that's right. I think the key is you got to keep shooting. You've got to keep working at it. If you stop, then you're not doing, then you're not a photographer. So, you know, just you have to keep at it one way or another.
Trey, on average, how many days out of the year are you shooting photos with the intention of getting a bunch of photos to bring back?
Yeah, well, once I hit a location, I go crazy at that location. So I just came back from San Francisco. I was there for...
missed you somehow. We were supposed to have dim sum, and it didn't happen.
Yeah, we're busy.
Yeah,
sorry about that.
It's all right.
But while I was out there for about 10 days or so, I just dumped everything into my Lightroom, in fact, now that I got home. After a trip, I feel this sensation that I just have got to get everything back on my home computer and dump it off, and then I can like relax and think about the world again. So anyway, I just dumped everything off into my Lightroom, and in California, I took about 3,000 photos. Out of those, I bet I'll have probably only like 100 that I'm really proud of. So typically, once I get to a location, I go crazy. I don't like to waste photos. I take it if I think it has potential, and then I'll get back home and really cull through them and pick out the winners. And just like Doug, I love post-processing. That's I think, you know, once you start loving post-processing as much as taking the photo itself, then it's a great thing.
Yeah, Doug, do you sell any of your photography? Obviously,
I have a good story about that.
Yeah, let's hear it.
I have a Smug Mug page. That's DougK.com.
Uh-huh.
And I put stuff there. And one of my images, two people wanted to buy prints of the image.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I sort of freaked out. I said, well, I don't know what the quality is going to be like. So I went, I ordered the prints first myself through Smug Mug to make sure they were right and all that. I sold two prints. And then I sold three more. It turned out those three were to my mother.
Oh.
So as of that point, 60% of what I had sold was to my own family, in fact, to my mother. I do sell a few prints. I plan to ramp that up a little bit through the Smug Mug stuff. And recently I've gotten into printing as an important part of the photography, so I may start selling them directly instead. I think the printing is an important part of it too.
For somebody who's, mother aside, well, she just likes your work, of course.
I told her, I said, I would have sent them to you for free, but she actually went in and bought the images.
My mom would have done the same thing. It's a very mom thing to do, you know, show support. But for the folks who are actually finding you organically via Smug Mug or your website, they'd heard of you and say, I love you, I love this, I want to buy it. If you're not used to, gosh, how much do I charge for this? Do I want to get as much as possible? What do I think this is worth? What do you do at that point? I mean, Trey obviously makes a business out of selling and licensing his photography. Do you ask other people who are more established?
Well, with something like Smug Mug, you can go see what other people charge.
Mm.
You can just go find
people. Just get a sense of the range.
Find people who make art that you somehow consider comparable to yours and see what the rates are. It's all over the place. There are people who charge some multiple of the cost of the physical print.
Mm.
And then there are people who say, my prints are worth, $500 for an 8x10.
Because that's what I choose to sell it for.
So, there's no right answer, but certainly the availability of information for research is out there. It's not a secret. So you can do that. And that's what I think people should probably do. It doesn't solve the problem. You still have to make the decision.
Right.
But at least the data's there.
So how have you approached it? For people who are asking you about a print, is it a certain percentage of what you felt your time was worth, time and energy and equipment?
I pulled a number out of my hat. I just guessed for now. But I am shifting towards doing my own printing and doing my own fulfillment of those orders rather than having them ordered. And the reason is simple. Well, actually, two things. One is, if you, I looked at the quality of the prints that were coming from the labs that just do it without me ever seeing them, and I wasn't really happy with them. And the other is, I really like printing. I've just gotten started. I'm brand new to printing, but I love that process too. And I like being able to control how the image looks all the way up until the final version. So, you know, I'll be revisiting the pricing at some point on that too. So we'll see.
All right, we have some tips. We've got favorite photos. Doug has a whole, it's just a box, really.
Bag of junk.
A bag of junk of gear. But before we get into that, I want to thank Netflix for sponsoring this episode of Twit Photo. We love Netflix around Twit because it is the easiest way to watch great movies, your favorite TV shows, entire series maybe that you need to catch up on or you never watched the first time around. If you're not familiar with Netflix, and it's unlikely because, of course, at Twit, we love talking about Netflix all the time. But if for some reason you don't already have a Netflix account, what you can do is go to Netflix.com and just get a sense of what they have to offer. Because some of the stuff is new current shows. Some of these movies are old classics. I mean, you really get a wide range of content depending on the kind of stuff you like to watch. If you've got kids, there is a ton of younger kids content, stuff that I've never heard of. But some of my co-hosts on other shows who have kids say, oh, that's why I love Netflix, because there's always something that they can watch. What's nice about Netflix is you can watch it via your Apple TV, your Roku box, on your laptop, whatever home system you might have, your iPad, your Android device. I mean, Netflix is, the beauty of it is, not only is it a movies and television on demand, but it's wherever you may be. In fact, that's the beauty of it. I sometimes start watching a movie when I'm at the gym. I'm on the treadmill for 30 minutes. I don't get through the whole movie. I get through some of it, and then I can pick it up when I get back to my living room exactly where I left off. Even some gaming systems, the Wii, the PS3, the Xbox, the list goes on. If you want to, try Netflix out. Give it a go. See how much content you can watch in 30 days. For free, go to netflix.com/twit to start your 1 month free trial. Again, I couldn't live without Netflix. There is something about on-demand TVs and movies that's just so much more fun than cable, because you can decide what you want to watch. You've got the series there. You can catch up on Mad Men. We must be so annoying talking about it week after week if you're not actually watching the series. Netflix can help you. You can get through the whole thing in 30 days if you try really hard. Again, that's netflix.com/twit, and we thank them for sponsoring this episode of Twit Photo. So, Doug, now that you are a big shot photographer, you probably have some tips for people like me who just have no idea what we're doing, even though we want to be good. We want to get better. Your first tip is about buying and selling, not necessarily new gear, but used.
Yeah, this is something that I found really valuable, especially being a geek and liking the gear. I started buying and selling gear on eBay a number of years ago. And, you know, if you buy a used lens, it tends to hold its value mm-hmm. pretty well. If you buy a $1,000 lens, you might sell it for $900 a few years later. That allows you to build your gear collection quite easily. Specifically, for example, a lot of people will start with a crop sensor camera like a 7D or a D7000 and want to work their way up to a full-frame camera. And you can start with the less expensive glass, buy the used but bigger glass, and then sell the old stuff. So it's worked out really well for me. I've bought many lenses. I've bought bodies. I've made some mistakes, I've had some problems, but I've invested some time in learning how to buy and sell on eBay. And Trey, you're probably not doing that, but what do you think about used gear in general?
Well, I will use this opportunity to plug an auction I'm about to have.
Oh,
I'm
really?
My Nikon D3X, my beloved camera, and I'm putting it on eBay tomorrow. So that's the big day. So I think eBay is a great place. Of course, it's a little bit self-serving in this instance, but it's great. I think
old camera equipment
is just as good as new camera equipment in most cases.
Yeah. Will you sign it?
Well, I won't be so vainglorious as to force my signature upon its body, but I will offer that if people want me to sign it. I will gladly sign it before it whisks away.
I think that'll do well. I mean, an example of this is when Nikon announced the D4, I said, oh, I need a D4, right? Well, I looked at it and realized, for me, a used D3S was everything I could possibly need in a camera and a lot less money. But I spent a lot of time seeing what they were worth, and in the case of the seller, researching the seller, finding out who she was. She's a real person. Turned out to be Lori Excel up in Portland, who's a well-known wildlife photographer. And so I bought her D3S. I've got her books that have images taken with that camera. So,
It was probably well taken care of.
You need to go to some trouble to do it. But that's my first tip, which is, buy and sell used gear. You can get a lot more for your money.
Now, you can...
Buy Trey Radcliffe's D4X in particular.
Yeah, and get it signed. He says he'll do it if you want him to.
I sold my D2X through eBay, and I ended up selling it for more than I paid for it. It turns out that, unbeknownst to me, one of my biggest demographics within my fan base is wealthy divorcees. And they pay a lot of money for used cameras from me. So
it must be. It's the hair.
So nice,
it's all because
you.
Of the hair.
Aw. What a sweet story.
It's the hair.
Yeah.
Is a lens... Okay. I could think of it almost... compare it to a used car, right? You'll save a lot of money if you buy a used car, because as soon as it goes off the lot, the value decreases quite a bit. Can a lens last forever as long as it's been taken care of? Well,
sure.
It'll depreciate over time, I assume.
No. Some of the old Nikon and Canon lenses are collector's items.
Yeah.
You can't get them. Some of them are extremely expensive. The one thing about the gear is, a couple of tips. One, make sure that the seller confirms it's a U.S. model. Nikon, in particular, will not repair a non-U.S. model. They're protecting their dealer and distribution chain.
Mm-hmm.
And I had one lens I sent them for repairs. They refused to touch it, and they dragged their feet in returning it to me. The other is ask the questions about condition. Do you guarantee it has no scratches? Are you guaranteeing it has no mold inside the lens? You have to ask these questions to get it right. But if you spend time on eBay seeing what other people are asking, you'll know what questions to ask yourself.
Now, what is auctionsniper.com? This is something that you use in conjunction with eBay.
Yeah. One of the tricks in buying an auction is, of course, all the bids come in the last minute or so.
Right.
So you don't want to be there at 2 a.m. and having to do it. And you don't want to make decisions in that emotional state of, oh, for a few more dollars, I could probably get it, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that's called sniping, when you make last minute bids. And there are many online tools for this. I use one called Auction Sniper, which allows me to enter the price I'm willing to pay. And it basically bids up to my maximum, but no more than it has to in order to get the item. So, an online sniping service is a big help in getting stuff.
It keeps emotional decisions out of the way, but it also helps you just manage auctions a lot more effectively.
Saves you money, because you don't spend more than you need to get the item.
Trey, do you do any eBay auctions as far as getting gear, or are you just getting rid of it?
No, although I'm not against it, I do use eBay a lot, but mostly to get stuff for my kids and things like that. I've kind of stopped buying DSLR equipment. I got a D800. That's sort of my latest purchase. But other than that, I don't see myself getting a lot more lenses. This is a bigger topic. I know Doug knows that I'm into this, but I don't think that DSLRs are going to be big in the next 3 or 4 years. So I'm not spending much more money on DSLR systems. I'm kind of advising other people don't either. But this is just my opinion.
This is a larger conversation, but I must know, you don't think that DSLRs are going to be big in the next, 3 to 5 years, because people are taking photos with iPhones? Or, where do you see the industry going?
I think the industry is going this way. This is the Sony NEX7, and this has a huge sensor on it. It shoots 10 frames per second. It has an amazing EVF, 24 megapixels. I mean, and this is right now. This is the beginning of 2012. I mean, I don't know what Sony will make late this year or early in 2013, but you know, these lenses, they're tiny, they're light. You can travel with, look how small it is. This is nothing. And this is a very powerful lens. So, you know, the trend that I see is everything is going in this direction. Smaller, faster, lighter, better. And, you know, I just don't see myself using a giant D800 camera in 3 to 4 years. I think that sports photographers will. I think that maybe like animal photographers or people that do high-speed action type stuff will. But that's going to become a smaller and smaller niche over time. I think you can get great images from these little guys.
So that's a Sony NEX7, correct?
Yes.
So what does a particular Sony model have that other competitors don't have in that particular space? And the reason I ask is because Sony's going through this whole restructuring model within the company itself and trying to figure out what they can make money still doing, and they've fallen off a little bit in the TV business. I mean, is there future in cameras?
Well, they've got a really strong digital camera line. They're really smart. These guys know what they're doing when it comes to the intelligence inside of these systems. And you know what's frightening, and I'm not embarrassed to admit this at all, I'll just go ahead and admit this, is that now I do understand everything about the camera. You know, I understand all the aperture and ISO and all that stuff. And I can go into manual all the time on any system and get it right. I can get it right. I know what to do in every situation. But this thing is so gosh dang smart. I just leave it in intelligent auto 80% of the time, and it just knows. Like, I move from indoor to outdoor. I'm shooting a flower. I'm shooting moving people. I'm shooting my kids running around. I shoot a landscape. It just knows what all the settings should be. And so now I can focus on the composition. I can work on, you know, getting my body in the right situation for the shot. And, you know, it's so smart. And so it's all trending kind of in this direction where the camera makes a lot of the decisions for you. So you can focus more on the art than the tech behind it. The sensors are great. Sony makes the same sensors that end up in the Nikon. So they understand that technology. You ask what makes it better than their competition. Really, not much. These are all shades of gray. But, you know, Panasonic and Fuji and all these people are getting into this new mirrorless line. And I think this has an amazing trajectory for the future.
Doug, you mentioned earlier in the show that you had joined a photo club, and that had been really good, just not only to meet other people that are like you, but to get ideas. Do you hear this sort of thing from your peers in photography
about
clubs?
About the mirrorless?
Well, just about the fact that cameras are so smart and they can do a lot of the work for you, and some of the focus can be left to composition and deciding what you're going to bring with you, not figuring out, you know, what f-stop to use at a certain point in any given photo shoot.
Well, unlike Google Plus, which is actually a fairly narrow range of people's technical abilities, or not technical abilities, but technical choices, the local photo club I'm a member of has a huge range. We have people with high-end DSLRs. We have people who only shoot with iPhones. Mm-hmm. And everything in between. We have people shooting film. So there's a huge range in our particular club. And I would think that's true in most of the places, too. I think Trey is absolutely right. He's just ahead of us in everything. I think next year is probably the big transition year. You know, the story, Trey's story is that he told everybody he was never going to buy another DSLR. And then the D800 came out and he just had to replace the D4X with an 800. But I'm sure he's right that he won't do that next year. I think next year is going to be the year when the next generation mirrorless cameras really are the best cameras for most people to own, from most people. They're so close. That Fuji X-Pro1 was really close, just not quite there yet for me.
What are some of the other things that you've learned from other people in these photo clubs? Because I can't imagine the highest-end DSLR user having so much in common with the iPhone user.
Well, see, again, it's great for me because, again, I'm working on the artistic, the creative part, in which case the gear doesn't matter at all. Mm-hmm. I mean, these people who shoot with iPhones in my club have gorgeous images, and I wish I could do it. I'm trying to learn how to do that with any camera. But the thing about the club, first of all, it's social, which is nice.
Yeah.
There are photo walks, which are great. But the main thing is we have formal competitions every month. We have digital competitions once a month. We have print competitions once a month. And they have a judge, they have rules, and putting your images into competition and watching other people in competition really brings everything up a notch. You learn when the judges look at the images, we might have 120 images. Tonight, for example, is our digital competition. We might have 120 images. The judge looks at each one for 3 seconds.
Wow.
Goes through them in groups, you know, and then comes back and gives a few comments and then judges them. And I'll tell you, you learn a lot. You learn a lot. And you get a different judge every month. They have different prejudices. So just putting your images into competition is a whole nother experience that a lot of photographers don't get. It's helped me a lot.
One of your other tips that you say has helped you a lot and allowed you to take back a little bit control if you're going to sell an image or just frame something is printing your own images. Is that expensive? Is it just a dark room that I'm building in my garage? What's your setup like?
Dark room, Sarah? Dark? You mean with developer and stop bath and hypo?
I see.
No,
I need help.
No.
I'm thinking of my college days.
They're digital. you know, you can get a very high quality printer now, like an Epson R3000.
Mm-hmm.
After rebates, the printer is $500.
Yeah. And how? What's the largest size that you can print?
That's probably going to do 13-inch wide. I think that does 13-inch wide by roll. So you can do 13 by 60 or whatever. Big enough.
Yeah.
The paper and the ink is where you spend all your money unless you don't print very much. And if you don't print very much, you probably shouldn't do it.
Mm-hmm.
The quality of the cameras are so good today that the camera does not limit our creativity. The quality of inexpensive printers is also so good that it doesn't limit our creativity. And I personally love the fact that I'm responsible for that very finished product, because it's not just the printing. It's the matting, the mounting, and maybe even the framing that I'm doing. I'm new to it. I'm still learning. But you know, I can print an image. I can say, you know, it's the color's a little off. It's a little light. I don't like something in this. And I'll print it again. It's going to be as good as I make it. And if you let somebody buy your images or license your images, you're not getting the benefit of that finished product. It also means, because you put so much work into it, that when you go out to shoot, you're not going to take a snapshot.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to spend the time to get the shot that you really want to use when you get back home and go through all that effort.
Does it allow you also to charge less for a finished product if you're actually the person getting your materials for framing and matting? Because I know when I go down to Frames R Us or whatever the place is nearby and I bring in something just to get framed and matted, it's like $200.
Yeah.
It is very expensive. And I'm obviously paying for their labor as well as their materials.
Right. Yeah, framing is particularly expensive. Matting's not too bad, but the one thing you get to do when you sell a print that you made is you get to sign it.
Mm.
So one could charge more for a signed print than one that comes out of, you know, Brand X Labs, you know, that they get mail order, essentially. But I think the sweet spot for most people is probably to print and sell them unmatted, unframed, just because of the cost of shipping them.
Sure. Unless you really enjoy it.
Yeah, unless they're particularly large. You may want to sell them in a standard size mat, because then the buyer can put it into a standard size frame.
Trey, do you work with a third-party framing, printing company, or do you do this stuff on your own?
No, I don't know anything about printing my own stuff. Really, that's a big black hole for me. I think probably I am exactly the same as Doug in that if I'm going to get into it, I'm really going to get into it. I don't want to just do it halfway. And it sounds like he's in the middle of really getting into it. So I have other third parties that print my various lines of work.
Do you get a chance to see prints, before they're approved or anything?
I get a variety of prints from my various printers, so I know generally what they look like. But, you know, I have hundreds and hundreds of images right. out there, and I don't get a version of them from all my printers into my home. So I just don't know what to do with them all.
It's easier.
So generally, I trust them to make really good prints, and I'm sure they do.
It's much easier when you sell half your prints to your mother.
She'll love it. So the blacks aren't so black. Right. It's the composition that matters. Doug, we want to talk about your favorite photos. I think Tony has at least a couple of these.
I don't trust Tony anymore.
Bubba's Diner.
This is fun. This is San Anselmo for those of you who
this
live in
this clearly looks like a photograph. This looks like, you know, almost like a watercolor painting.
This was fun. This was done on a photo walk with the local photo club. And I played with it many, many ways. It's an HDR image. I think it was five exposures, one stop apart. A lot of post-processing work, but mostly the decision at the end was to use a little bit of selective color. So it's a monochrome image. I don't know how well it comes across on the video.
Yeah.
We see it fine.
Sure.
Yeah. And but it has a little bit of selective color, and this has been a very popular image for me, and I'm proud of it because I think the images that I like the best are ones that at the end of the day I say can tell a story, and this is part of the series on closed. So here's Bubba's, which is open, but the sign says closed, and there's a story, and that awning that says where grease meets organic, that's the real awning. That's what they have at Bubba's.
Now, you say this is an HDR photo, use some selective coloring. The image is amazing, but I can't tell what time of day it is. I can't really bring it into reality. Mm-hmm. What was the situation?
It was night, dark, mm-hmm. Long exposures, I think five long exposures, you know, varying lengths to get the different f-stops, but... that light was, the light on the chair and tables out front was just what was spilling out from the interior pretty much onto the street.
Love it. All right, let's see the next favorite photo. Pacific
this,
Made.
This is a recent one. This is also an HDR image. And the giveaway to that, by the way, is that the roof of that boat is brighter than the sun. That should be a clue right there, right, Trey? And this was a boat on Maui. There had been a big storm, and this boat had actually run aground and was sitting there and went out. I drove past it and then went back and caught it just at sunset. And again, this was at least five images because of the dynamic range. I mean, in one image, to get that sunset, that boat was essentially all in the dark. That would be a very dark image there normally.
So you said the dead giveaway for HDR, because sometimes HDR is very obvious,
yeah.
And sometimes it's not. It can make a mediocre picture really amazing. Mm-hmm. You said the top of the boat was lighter than it would have been in reality.
Yeah, Tony, go back to that again. You'll see, I mean, if you look at just the luminosity, the brightness of this, mm-hmm. the white on the boat is almost pure white, almost. And the sun is as bright as it could be, you know, given the monitor that we're looking at. Well, in reality, there's no way that boat could be as bright. It's in the shade, first of all.
Yeah.
It's the shady side of the boat. There's no way it's going to be as bright as that sun. So if you know what to look for, my HDR images are not, I try to avoid the HDR look that people talk about. I'm using it as a way to compress dynamic range, period. It's a technical challenge. And that's why I got into HDR, is because I wanted to be able to shoot interiors with mm-hmm. exterior things and so forth. So anyway, that's the secret in spotting it. But I'm happy with this one. I like the way it again tells a story about this boat that's ran aground, and there's this very dramatic sky. And, is that the storm that put the boat aground? I don't know. It wasn't, but...
It's beautiful.
Thank you.
It's a beautiful image. Let's talk about your gear.
Oh,
we've got this gear I've been looking at down at your feet this entire show.
Oh, I got it.
So let's see what some of your favorite...
because people bring...
Favorite toys
People are. Always show up on Twit Photo with, you know, cameras and lenses.
Right.
Right. Well, we don't want to do that. We want to do something different.
Okay.
So this is little things from my studio. This is... Which camera are we going to use? This one. All right.
There you go.
So this is a Manfrotto clamp. I can't remember what it's called. Is it a J clamp? Tony knows what it's called. He'll tell you in your ear. But this is an inexpensive clamp that you can use to clamp onto anything. You can put a strobe on it. You can put a small camera on it. You can put a flag to block some light. That's a very handy thing. You can make them yourself, too, from the something from the hardware store. But this one happens to be made from Manfrotto. It's called a 175, Model 175. Very common, very popular. There it is. Spring clamp. There you go.
So if you're buying it, it's about $20 or so.
$20, yeah.
Yeah. That seems like a great thing to have in your back pocket.
Oh, it's great. And, you know, everybody's got to have a couple of them, right? And then I came across this thing. This is called a Wimberly Plamp. P-L-A-M-P. I don't know what it can
sounds like something from Harry Potter.
Yeah, yeah.
A Wimberly Plamp.
Right. It does, doesn't it? This is, you know, it looks like a Gorilla Pod in the sense
it does.
That it's
in fact, that's what I thought it was.
Things, right? But it's a long arm that you can stretch. You can clamp this end onto anything. Let's get a look at that. You can clamp this end onto something. And this end is a lighter weight clamp. You can hold a little card or reflector or something. So, again, in studio photography, you'll often need to clamp this onto your table or your tripod. And this end, let's see, which way does it go? This way. And this way, it'll hold something in some awkward position so you don't have to.
Mm-hmm.
So that's called a plamp. And this is about, I don't know, what is it, 20... Doesn't say that, but I think it's around $25.
This one looks like so. This one says $37. It's
$37. There you go.
$37.
Very handy.
The plamp.
The plamp. There you go. That's cool.
You could use that. You could attach it to your iPad, and the other end you could put your stylus on, so you never lose it.
You could.
That's exactly what I could use the plamp for.
Yeah.
My stylus. Well, you can, I mean, but just even if you have a tripod and then you've got this, all of a sudden you have all sorts of different scenarios as far as holding multiple pieces of gear.
I've had all of these in use at once in one way or another. But then you can go up to the big guy.
Okay.
This is the snake. Of course it is. Yeah. Of course it is. Yeah. Everyone has to have one. This is also made by Manfrotto, and this is really cool because it folds up like that, but it's in these sections, each of these 90-degree sections. You can combine it in any old way you want. And when you, this end has what's called a super clamp. You can get it with or without the super clamp. I think with the clamp, it probably costs about $220. It's not cheap.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But when you get this into the position you want, $240. Thank you, Tony. When you get this into the position you want, you take this end. Here, you do it. Tighten that down. Other way. Just tighten that all the way.
Okay.
And now feel how strong that is.
Okay. Right? So that's why it's so much.
Yeah.
Because it's like indestructible.
Really solid.
Nothing's going to move.
Right.
You can
put a heavy DSLR on this.
Uh-huh.
And mount this in some strange place. So this is an amazingly cool gadget for $230-some.
Trey, are any of these gadgets in your bag as well?
No.
What do you have against the snake and the Wimberly plamp?
No, I mean they're very cool, but I mean
he travels.
I travel light.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Travel light.
And
they're cool though.
He's not generally taking images of small things.
Mm-hmm.
He's a big image photographer.
Right. Speaking of landscape photography.
Yeah, really.
So that's cool. That's the snake arm with super clamp again from Manfrotto.
Manfrotto, right. Now, I started doing this series, as I said, of establishments that are closed, which means I put my lens right up against the window, which means I got all the reflections from the glass, right?
Yeah.
I got myself in the picture and all these things that I don't want. And I used to take a dark sweater. I used to take gaffer's tape and put that up. Well, somebody came up with a lens skirt.
I do have that.
You do?
Yes.
Cool. So what is this? This is about, it's expensive. It's like 50, put that up, right? $50, you'd say, God, I can make one. But I'll tell you, you can't actually make one this good for $50. You put this end around the lens,
mm-hmm.
right? Here, let me do it this way. So this end goes around your lens. You cinch it down.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have four suction cups that go up against the glass.
To the window.
Right? We can just do this on Trey's face like that. Right?
Yeah. But I don't like calling it a skirt. I like calling it a man pant.
Oh, there you go. The lens man pant. Right? And
depends on the photographer, I guess, because I'm not using any man pant
no,
in my closed window series.
There you go.
So,
So this is great when you have to shoot through a window and you don't want reflections.
That is so good.
And it also is really tiny. And I have only one more thing.
All right.
And it has a special reason.
Okay.
Because it is the thing that when I go out to shoot, more people ask me about a notice than anything else.
What in the... keeps things level, right?
It's a level. And this, of course, is... Trey Ratcliffe is probably as famous for this as anything else. This is like... How much does this cost, Trey? $10?
Yeah, you might be able to get two for $10.
Yeah, two for 10. But you can get them at Photo Jojo and places like that. It is a three-axis level.
Uh-huh.
You put it in the flash shoe and you level your camera. But Trey knows... You'll be out in the wilderness somewhere, people, and you'll have a fancy camera and a big lens and a nice solid tripod. People come up to you and say, "What's that?" And it's the little green cube in your flash shoe that gets all the attention.
It's a conversation starter.
Now, this whole thing is just designed to keep your photos level, right?
Right.
Well, no, it's really designed to start conversations amongst other photographers. Because if you're lonely or whatever, you just put on your camera, eventually someone will walk up to you and they're curious. And
I suspect, is that you just want to talk to other people with this, because can't you fix your horizon in post? Do you really have to worry about it that much while you're there taking the photo?
Well, there are two things. One, if you fix your horizon in post, you're going to have to change your crop.
Yeah.
Right? Because you're going to lose some horizontal and vertical. And now this is getting geeky, and Trey and I have never talked about this. But if you have to rotate the image, you're going to lose some resolution. Right? You're moving, you're creating new pixels from old pixels.
Uh-huh.
You're not just moving pixels.
Yeah.
So there's a certain interpolation that has to happen. Now that's really geeky, especially if you have a 36 megapixel camera.
But the takeaway is, if you can get it right while you're out there, that's ideal.
Right, because that way, especially if you have a camera that has 100% viewfinder, some don't,
mm-hmm.
right? But if you have it, you know, you want to get the shot. And if you do this, you can come home and not have to crop anything.
What's the name of this again?
It's a Trey Ratcliffe.
Cube.
A little level cube. I don't know.
It's
what
great.
It's not my... If you just Google green cube or a camera,
green
and
cube
you'll end up on Amazon.
And you'll get it.
So
well,
when
this
I, when
is,
I,
this
when
is
I knew,
actually, I need this because I'm incapable of getting anything straight.
When I knew Trey was on our show today, I decided that had to go into the grip bag.
Love it.
So
love it.
Thank you, Trey.
Sure.
So what's next? What's next for you, Doug? You have photography projects on the horizon. Are you going to sell more stuff? Are you taking any big trips to get photos of places you've never been before?
That's a trick question.
It's not a trick question. I'm really serious.
I want to travel more, go more places, because one of the things you learn is if you want to get great images like Trey Ratcliffe does,
mm-hmm.
you have to go to great locations.
Yes.
You know,
he's a world traveler, and that's how he has all those beautiful shots
and
of everything.
And he himself has been stuck in customs.
Mm-hmm.
But you need the subject matter. You're not gonna find a lot of great photographs in your garden. You know, you'll find a few. So going to locations, shooting more. For me, I'm primarily learning. And my biggest thrill about the photography comes from learning and getting better. So I'm going to do all of the above because I'm still at that stage where most of my pleasure comes out of doing something that I couldn't do before.
Yeah.
Is learning a new skill, you know, creating an image that I'm proud of. And I have the luxury of not having to sell my work to support the hobby. So I'm going to keep doing that. So more of the same.
DougK.com is where people can see some of your work. Where are some other places that Google Plus, for example, that you're you've been hanging out online, where people can connect with you?
You can find me on Twitter at Doug as Doug K on Twitter. You can find me on Facebook as Doug K. There are other Doug K's, but I've pretty much got that one locked down.
Yeah. So you're everywhere.
I try to be.
You're busy online. Well, thank you so much, Doug, for coming and hanging out and talking to us about your method, your very interesting history, and how you got to where you are now. It sounds like you're having a lot of fun. And Trey Ratcliffe, thank you for joining us from the great state of Texas. We know where you can be found because you actually host a Google Hangout that we're running on Twit now. But what about where other people want to find you online?
Yeah, so we have that show that's on every Monday night on the Twit Network.
Trey's Variety Hour.
Trey's Variety Hour. We had a really fun show last night that's being encoded for the podcast right now. Otherwise, you know, I just put up a new photo every day on stuckincustoms.com. And I hang out on Google Plus quite a bit, but I'm also on Facebook and Twitter as well. So just about anywhere you can find me if you so desire.
All right. Well, thanks to both of you for being here. A couple of reminders of stuff that you should know about. Catherine Hall, of course, the normal Twit Photo co-host, who is with Leo Laporte in Norway as we speak, is hiring. She's hiring for her studio. If you want to know more about it, maybe you are a budding photographer, photography assistant, or know somebody who is, please visit catherinehall.net. She's got a blog post about who she's looking for. And that is, what a fun job that would be. A very talented, smart woman. And both Catherine and Trey will be at the Google Plus Photo Conference May 22nd, 23rd, the afternoon before on May 21st. Mm-hmm. Doug, you will participate in a photo walk down at Fisherman's Wharf in San Francisco. So again, if anyone's interested in joining that, it's at G plus PC. So the letter G, PLUSPC.com/register to take advantage of that. Sounds like a really fun event.
Should be.
Absolutely. Thanks to both of you. For now, I'm Sarah Lane. I will not be here next week because Catherine and Leo will be back with a special episode of footage from all the fun that they've been having in Norway. You will not want to miss it. Until then, take lots of pictures, and we'll see you next week.